Right now on Robinhood Radio, it is time to bring in David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. Of course, you can find David here on a Friday morning live. We rebroadcast David on the weekends and also during our noontime block the following week. Also, by the way, his own site, themediabeat.us. Now, David, also on top of all of that, you can find him at Huffington Post, and he is also a PBS television correspondent. He does reporting on ethics and belief. And on top of that, well, I don't know where it can fit anything else in. Good morning, David.
Good morning. I'm happy to be with you more than anywhere else.
At this particular time.
At this particular time, right. I'm reporting to you from the media capital of the world, New York City. I'm happy to be back in this country, and I'm happy to be talking to you.
Well, you know, it's interesting. David sent a note along this week, and he's got a another appearance coming up this weekend on the PBS NewsHour, and it will be a part of his reports on ethics. And what's interesting, David, is when I looked at what you're going to talk about ethical questioning, about architects who design prisons. Should they refuse to include solitary confinement? I spoke to somebody, and this was about a year, maybe two, maybe years ago, who worked in a prison. And they use other words now other than solitary confinement.
You bet they do. Yeah. Prisons, prison administrations are very fond of, well, all administrations are very fond of jargon of their own, of course. And jargon in professions tends to be usually a form of euphemism, and that's certainly true of prison jargon. Solitary is sometimes called interesting things like special housing or administrative segregation. How about that?
Isolation.
What was the one you had?
isolation room for almost like it was for protection. Isolation room.
Well, often it is for protection, of course. I mean, on the whole, solitary confinement is used for punishment purposes, additional punishment purposes, when people infringe rules or in some way or other are problematic for the administration. But of course, there are many people who would be at risk themselves in the general population in a prison, and they're put in solitary for their own safety. But that's a minority. The vast majority of people are in there because they're difficult to handle.
Now, have you been looking
at... And of course, the important point to note is that the number of people who are in that condition of confinement, solitary, is 80,000. As someone in my report on PBS News on the PBS NewsHour this weekend points out, who's an architect and arguing that architects shouldn't be involved in building such confinement units, he said that's almost as many as there are qualified architects in this country. So you know, it's a as we know. Mass incarceration is almost an epidemic in this country. We are one of the world leaders in the size of the population that we put behind bars. Within that, there is this particular community of vast numbers also, 80,000 people living their lives 23 hours a day entirely on their own, with all the psychological evidence that there is, and it's mounted over the decades, that this can cause extraordinary mental damage.
Now, let me ask you a question about prisons, and especially modern day prisons in America. America has gone more and more and more to private companies running prisons.
It's just what I was going to ask. It's industrialized.
It's almost become like a big business in this country.
It is a big business.
It's an industry.
Yes. In a way, that's why I came at it from this architecture angle,
right?
Because the number of prisons being built in this country has gone up in the last 40 years. something like fourfold, almost four times as many, up from a base of about 500 in the 1970s to almost 2,000 now. And that's an extraordinary rise. And you're quite right, a very large I haven't got the number, the proportion with me right to hand, but an extraordinary proportion of that are built privately, and many of them are, of course, administered privately too, on behalf of state authorities, and sometimes federal authorities too, but mainly state authorities and county authorities have private companies running their prisons.
So, what does one do about oversight? Is it a bidding thing? I mean, it just seems that there are so many places where bad things can happen, she said diplomatically. Seems like there are
the
many
oversight of privately run prisons is spotty at best. Yeah, that's the inevitable concomitant, I think, of opting to go for a commercial solution to what appears to be a problem, which is that we need more prisons. And of course, we need more prisons because sentencing policies have changed over time. I think we're past the hump of it now. I think the error of our ways in the last few decades is starting to get recognized. And now the prison population is actually, for the first time in a long time, declining. But the reason it grew in the first place in this dramatic way was the biggest single reason, anyway, was the extraordinary upsurge in harsh sentencing, particularly for drug policies, for drug crime, alleged drug crimes, drug-related crimes. And, of course, the mandatory nature of those sentences. Judges had no... for a long time, had no real discretion about that, and people had to go to jail, and therefore, you know, new jails had to be built, and then populations grew, got more unmanageable. Unmanageability led to more and more people being put into solitary confinement. So it's a growing monster. Now perhaps being headed off, but we're left with a huge population and a huge population in solitary. And that's why you got this new campaign amongst progressive-minded architects to change the code of ethics for the profession of architects, saying that in order to make it say that it's unethical for an architect to build a solitary confinement unit because it's an outrage against human rights and it's dangerous for mental health and all the other reasons. In particular, the fact that in the global human rights campaigning world, it's regarded as a form of torture. Solitary confinement equals torture. That's the basis of their argument.
So... it's good. How do you say this? It's always good to have an argument.
Well, exactly. I mean, here's an argument going on within the profession about a vital public issue for the public at large, but the architects are trying to tackle it from their own particular professional point of view, and it's interesting that that's happening. The American Institute of Architects has been somewhat open to the argument, but they haven't changed their code of ethics very much. I mean, there's a small emendation to their code now. There is for the last 2 years a kind of reminder. It's a standard, not a rule. Their code of ethics divides into two kinds of guidelines for architects. One is a set of standards, and the other is a set of hard rules which are enforced. Well, this is not a rule, but it's a standard that basically it says that the architect shouldn't build anything that doesn't conform with the idea of human dignity. That's not good enough for the campaigning architects who want a real change, who want to make it specifically an unethical bit of architectural behavior to design solitary confinement, and that's what our argument is about on this piece that we're putting out on PBS NewsHour this weekend on Sunday. Times will vary in different markets, as you know, with PBS broadcasts a lot of the time, But that's what we're doing on Sunday of this weekend.
And I think it's a worthy use of people's visual abilities and brain cells, because I'll tell you, it at least it's nuanced to a degree that.
Well, reporting's not reporting if it's not nuanced, it seems to me. And we've had this discussion a lot.
Well, you know, I'm now having it.
And we're not seeing it, we're not seeing it often enough. Nuanced reporting, and we're just trying at the PBS NewsHour to do our bit, to go into issues in some depth, and that's the purpose of the exercise.
But you know, I am heartened, because I suspect that outside of let's call it the industry that is very committed to things being the way that they are now, I think that there's a real hunger and interest both in tactile. Proper visual. I'm not talking about the people who are already lost. I'm talking about the new group coming up who couldn't be, who don't view life.
You're talking about generations of media consumers, are you?
I'm talking about the next generation of media consumers who is sort of curious and sort of interested in all sorts of things that they actually don't know how to do, and can't believe that they're being given what they have been given. I'm just starting to see inklings of it, so it's more heartening to overuse.
Well,
that.
I hope we're breeding a generation of critical consumers of media. That does seem to be the case. I mean, I think we're long past the days when people could say, in the old days, oh, it's true because I read it in the papers. I'm not sure that's ever really been true, but there's a kind of assumption that at some halcyon time, people trusted the mass media, such as it was in whatever technological form it took. And now, with every single person having, or not, I mean, every single person who has electricity and an internet connection, which in many industrialized countries is a huge proportion of the population, they will all themselves have access to the media, social media, mass media, whether it's in form of comment or in form of your own platform. Comment on existing media or a platform for expressing your own thoughts in the media. You've got something like a Wild West spirit where anything goes, and there's no particular reason to believe anything.
Which
that's the nature of this so-called post-truth society that we've got.
And I can't think of anything more comical than calling it post. I mean, it's like call it post-truth long enough, and no wonder everybody's walking around in a distorted fog, not knowing which way.
Absolutely,
One of my favorite things last week that came out.
It's
was,
as if Goebbels had achieved his ultimate Valhalla.
I know. It's just, really? Really? You all want this to happen? But
post-truth?
But why not? Because I don't.
Well, it, in a sense, it's what we've got. Well,
that's what I mean. So I'm not going to argue that.
It's an exaggerated expression, an exaggerated passing of what we've got. What we've got is a media landscape in which truth is very, very hard to find.
How about that?
It's very hard to define too for many people, which is even more troubling.
But what I think is going to happen. Well, and I mentioned this to Marshall yesterday, but again, this has been in conversation. It's like, as with telecom companies, as with record companies, just, you know, there is a cycle where everybody splits up and you've got the baby bells, right? And then everything is reabsorbed into the mothership. And this doesn't happen overnight. This happens over let's just say 25 years. And then you turn around and you're like, we want our independence. We want our independence. So what I think has happened with these all of these platforms and with everybody being their own editor or selector of information is that it now leaves room for a few major outlets to, pick up the mantle of saying, well, look, you know, we at least have somebody there. So how about we send her, him, it off to have a look? And
Yes, reporting capacity, just the capacity to put boots on the ground. That's one of the things that has shrunk in the constrained financial landscape of the media these days. Yeah, very, very few organizations, certainly in the United States of America, are the kind of reporting machine that the big newspapers once upon a time were. They could send people hither and thither and get authentically researched reports from the front line, as it were, or on the ground, wherever you'd want to have reporters. Nowadays, everybody's sharing what appears to be a shrinking labor force of professional and experienced reporters.
And because of that, everybody is getting the same information, but sort of just filtered through. It rather reminds me of, you know, when a frequent cable guest, you know, makes the rounds of the different channels, saying the same thing but slightly differently depending on which channel,
which outlet is speaking at that moment.
Else
you have just straightforwardly two major camps, one set of liberal pundits and another set of conservative pundits, and you know where you'll find them. You'll find them in the conservative media and you know, matchingly, the liberal media on the other side of the divide. The partisanship of broadcasting, in particular in this country, is matching the extraordinary partisanship of the public as a whole, and this of course is another manifestation of what we often talk about, our respective insulated bubbles of our own.
Well, also, if they weren't making a bloody fortune, I mean, and I always watch this. There are, I don't know, several new drugs that I've noticed being marketed, but it's exactly, and this I find, I mean, to me, this is a clincher. It doesn't matter what outlet you sample, you get the same ads, exactly the same ads, tailored to the same people. Those don't change. In other words, the same pharmaceutical is on A, B, or C. It's not a different, it's not, it's outside the camps, if you know what I mean.
Well, and yes, I guess even if you're a conservative or a dyed-in-the-wool liberal,
you still buy Land Rover.
You're still into the same drugs. Pharmaceutical marketers are that wise, at least.
Or the same. You will find the same high-end vehicles and the same high-end cruises, because it has occurred to advertisers though it might be a shock to people watching. One of the outlets or the other. There are people of similar means on both sides.
Sure. I mean, there are only two main axes for the graph of, through, you know, or the filter, if you like, through which a marketer will look. One is the checkbook, and the other is the age. Of the audience, and that's what they're mainly interested in. So we shouldn't be surprised to find the same.
No, it's not surprising,
exactly,
but
the same advertising phenomenon you're describing.
But it should, but it should also tell anybody, again with a few working brain cells, that what's really going on here and why. So
journalism is ever identified by, or characterized rather by its basic need in the Western world. It's essentially a business proposition. You need customers. You need news sells papers and clicks, multiple clicks will sell advertising, and drug companies will advertise where they think it's most profitable to advertise, whether it's left wing or right wing.
Oh, I don't want to understate. Just if one wants to take a moral stance there would be no vehicles on the streets of the media capital of the world.
Well, of course, right.
You know, and that's and then there's a
unless you're in favor of multiple fatalities from a moral point of view. I mean, if you want to start an ethical discussion of why, well. Yes, we know where that road takes us.
Right. No, we're not going to start an ethical discussion because otherwise there's a word, and I wish I had more logic training, you know, because there's a word for that kind of argument, and I can't come up with it right now. But
self-serving or circular or solipsistic.
Yeah. No, I know those words. There's a fancy name for it. It was named after the first person who did it or said it or whatever. But I'm being informed actually by
either Adam or Eve, I would imagine.
Yeah, or both. You know, it could have been a joint statement from the Garden of Eden.
Okay, the warden's got to come in here and put you two in confinement here because we're out of time.
What's the right word for it?
Isolation. Isolation. I'm putting you guys in an isolation compartment room.
Righto. All right, is this going to be rebroadcast, David, or is it just because we
for now it's just a one-off, but of course the news are quite often will, particularly when it comes around to, guess what, fundraising time,
yep.
Just to remind us that it all depends upon getting the funds for our journalism. It may well be repeated during a pledge week or that kind of thing.
The reason that I'm mentioning it is because we rebroadcast you, so this is going to be on Sunday the 23rd, correct?
That's right.
All right.
The PBS NewsHour weekend in different markets tends to be shown at different times. It can be very early. It's meant to be a prime time evening show, but an awful lot of public TV stations will carry it much earlier than that. I've even seen it scheduled at 5:30 in the afternoon.
Well, for some people who get up really early, that is prime time.
You're up.
Our warden himself is a perfect example.
Well, yes, of course. You early morning radio people are a race apart. You're almost like the old time farmers. You get up so early. I have to tell you, it's extraordinary that you have me live on a Friday morning. I'm not normally functioning at this time of day. Only on Fridays and only for Robin Hood Radio.
And we really appreciate that.
We're also a lot like farmers because we till a lot of manure.
You're experts at that.
And
yes.
By the way, that's why we originally captured you. We knew you didn't like getting up there.
Well, I've spent a lot of time in the manure fields, tilling it over and trying to get to the I won't take this metaphor any further.
We'll just say thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, the Media Beat.